Hello, my name is Sandra Polifroni, and today I'm talking to Kisten Koza, the author of Lost in Moscow, A Brat in the USSR, published by Turnstone Press. Hi, Kisten.
Kisten.
Even I have trouble because I see the name written on the book.
Of course.
And my brain seems to think, oh yeah, it's Kirsten, but
yeah,
no, it's Kisten.
Yep, that's what everybody does. Yeah, except if you're from Denmark, and then you go Kisten.
Are you from Denmark?
No.
Pardon?
No, you're not from Denmark. You're from here. You're from Ontario.
I'm from Ontario. Well, I was born in England, actually, but my grandmother is Danish, and so I have Danish heritage, which ended up with a Danish name.
The book is, well, it's a really weird book, because you were sent at age 11 to the USSR to go to a camp, to like a summer camp, and then you went through all these adventures. How did you manage to get sent to... How did you manage to go to the USSR at age 11 in 1977? And why did your parents let you go? It was the height of the Cold War.
The height of the Cold War. Because my grandma, my little English grandma, who has the Danish heritage, was decided in the 70s that she was a communist. And so she was hanging out with all these fellow sympathizers of communism in Toronto and going to meetings on Queen Street, and they would watch propaganda films, and they would drink tea, and they would just be, I don't even really know what to call them, except that I think that they were such rebels, that they were rebels against, if they had been in Russia at that time, if they had been in the USSR, they would have been going to democracy meetings in a basement and drinking tea, and doing, or vodka probably there. And so anyway, she basically raffled me off. She gave my name to the Soviet government. The Communist Party was looking for people from Canada who would sign up their children to go to camp. And so they had a raffle. And our names were all put in a bin, and we were selected. And I honestly don't think that there were very many names put into the bin. Every single kid from across Canada that went, there were 11 of us that ended up being selected. I think every single one of us that was put into the bin was selected to go to Soviet summer camp for the entire summer.
But yet there was that girl Dee Dee that you write about in the book. She was obviously from a very rich family, and yet how did her parents send her to Russians, Soviet summer camp?
Well, her bubby was a member of the Soviet Friendship Center as well, going to the meetings with my grandmother. So once again, Dee Dee was entered, her name was put in the bin. And I think, I think for many people's parents, it was such an experience, a huge experience. All of a sudden, your child is being offered, I mean, the Soviet government paid for the whole thing.
Wow.
Except for the flight going over. So all of a sudden, your child is being offered this huge cultural experience. And so some people, I think, were going for the cultural experience. My parents, I think, partly were going for a cultural experience, but also my parents actually were fairly still in their sort of newlywed stages, actually, because my dad's not my natural dad. And and I had my bedroom right beside my parents' bedroom. And I think they just went, woohoo, get this cold in the summer. And but then I think there were other kids there. I mean, there was a boy from Alberta, Sam, and I mean, he was going through a huge amount of problems, and he was, I mean, I think probably emotionally disturbed in some sort of way. He had a lot of developmental problems, and I think his mom thought, well, Sam's gone for the summer. So there was a whole mix of reasons why 11 kids from across Canada ended up being sent to the USSR for the entire summer.
Yeah, there was Big Carl and Little Carl,
yes.
Two communist kids.
Yes. Yes, and they absolutely, and their dad at university, he teaches, he teaches Black History and Karl Marx. And
wow.
Absolutely, you know, he's a prof, and so, I mean, they were incredibly well-versed compared to the rest of us in everything, and everything about communism and the politics of the times.
Yeah, little Carl kept on calling you a capitalist.
Yeah, capitalist, like it was a really bad thing. And I had no idea what a capitalist, when I was 11, and I had not a clue what a capitalist or a communist was when I went. And, you know, first thing, showing up in the airport, and a little boy's going, catalyst.
So was it ever settled? Did he hate you or like you?
Well, I think he hated me, to be honest. I feel like he hated me that whole summer. He hated me with passion.
Wow. What were you told about the USSR before you left? Because throughout the book, you're going, I have no idea what people are talking about.
And yeah, I have nothing. I didn't know where I was going. I went for tea before with my grandmother at the USSR club, and I'd watched some of the films, and there were, like, Soviet children inventing solar cars and doing all these amazing things. And the camp that I was sent to was a super camp. It was the camp that they sent their Olympic hopefuls.
No kidding.
Yeah, and their genius children. And so there were three of these. There were 25 million children in the USSR in 1977. And all of them had to go to a summer camp for all their holidays, no choice. They went to them at the winter holidays as well. They went to camps for all holidays. And there were three super camps in the entire USSR, and our camp accommodated 3,000 children.
Wow.
So you think out of 25 million, they're probably the others are the same size, so 9,000 of these kids get to go to a super camp. The rest of them were going to other camps.
Oh, the pioneer camp?
They were going to the other pioneer camps, and these were all pioneer camps, but I would guess that, I mean, they showed us a regular camp,
right,
which I was really surprised, actually, that the Soviet government would show us this, because the other camp was, I mean, made me think of Hogan's Heroes.
Maybe you should clarify what Hogan's Heroes is for those of us too young for it. I know because I'm a pop culture junkie, but...
Well, he would have to be, but it is. I mean, how would you describe Hogan's Heroes?
Guys in a POW camp.
Yes, and so, yeah, and so that's exactly what they looked like. It looked like a place that you were trapped for your holidays instead of a place that you would go to enjoy yourself. But I still think that even at the camp I was at, I mean, in some ways they were having holidays, but some ways it was still competition after competition after, it was so competitive.
But you got to parachute without lessons.
Yeah, well, I think I slipped through the cracks there. I wasn't supposed to parachute without lessons, that's for certain. that was probably a really bad thing.
But were you given any briefings at all before you left? Like, I mean, and like the first incident happens in the plane where you're chewing gum, and Adrian, who I'm not exactly sure what was up with Adrian, the way you wrote him in, was he really like that? He starts yelling at you, no gum.
He's still like that, actually.
You still know him?
He's still like that. He still drives a Lada.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Oh my God.
He does. He still drives a Lada.
Does it still work?
Absolutely. And last time I saw him, he had the long beard that he would still pull into his point. And he is absolutely, I think for a lot of the people that organized this and the people that were passionately involved in this, and I've since talked to the head of the USSR Association, and him in particular, I found quite interesting too, because when you read the North Star, which is his sort of communist pamphlet that he puts out on the internet and things like that, and if you just Google it, you can find it. And, I mean, they talk about working at putting the USSR back together and denying things that have happened in, Yugoslavia. And, you know, Milosevic isn't, he's been framed. And, like, really quite an out there thing.
Right, because on the plane, the first thing, I mean, the guy is, like, really weird. I mean, first thing he does is you're on the plane, your ears are popping, you're chewing gum, and he starts yelling at you.
Oh, of course, not that gum was illegal in the USSR.
But,
it was illegal.
But you weren't told any of this before you...
I didn't bring gum. That was actually my friend from British Columbia who became my bosom buddy there. And, I mean, we became friends right off the bat. She had the gum. My mother was very... I mean, I had the tiniest little suitcase for that entire summer, which, I mean, also kind of stresses me out when I think about it now, because I had this little suitcase and I don't remember them ever doing laundry.
Oh.
The other kids that were there with me too, the ones that I've managed to track down because of the internet. This is so great, you can find people. And the other ones, none of us remember laundry.
Oh my God! So you wore dirty clothes
for the entire summer. We remember that they washed the marching uniforms and things like that, and you would see them, you know, because at camp, in some ways it was like being in the military, and you would have to march each morning, and you were woken up by the bugle blowing, and you would have all these, you know, things that you had to do that were very military-like. And And the whole camp, I mean, it was decorated with warplanes, and there was, we did cosmonaut training. I mean, the whole camp was set up for taking the Soviets to the whatever steps that they were going to. This is not like going to summer camp in Canada or Ontario. There's no marshmallows and bonfires or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but how, I mean, you wrote, this happened in 1977, and
yeah.
You wrote the book, I mean, this has been a while now.
Right.
Since 1977. I mean, it's been, what's 30 years? Almost 30 years.
Right, right.
How did you manage to remember all this? Was it, like, indelibly printed? Or are you...
Of course. I mean, some of that is. But, I mean, I kept a day-to-day diary, and I didn't miss a day.
But you wrote it for your parents, though, because you thought your parents were going to be reading your diary.
Yeah, I know. So I actually did some, diary... I did some cleansing of my diary as I wrote it. But what I find is, like, really bizarre is I seem to... Like, every time I lied in my diary, that moment is so huge for me as, oh, I was lying, and I remember the truth from, I remember, I guess you remember, I don't know what it is, but I would read, and I know I was lying there, and I know exactly what really would happen, like, because, you know, there was a pile of things that I did diary cleansing stuff, but I also had a scrapbook that I had, I brought my little camera with me, and I took photos, and I captioned beside each one of them, and I kept every piece of junk that you could imagine. They're all displayed on my website, you know, from chocolate bar wrappers to name
thermometer.
It. And I capped it all, and I put it into the scrapbook.
One of the things is the rectal thermometer, the big, long, thick of your thumb rectal thermometer. Are you sure you're not exaggerating?
Totally not. I got that rectal thermometer from I don't have it. But I actually was given an image of it on a ruler by a former Soviet who now lives in Ottawa, and a woman who did a lot of the Russian translation, went over the Russian translation in my book. Her husband actually sent me the digital image against a ruler of the Soviet rectal thermometer that they swear has never been up anyone's bum. they use it under the armpit and stuff, and they said it just works so well. But the translator had that did this also had an experience in the USSR with a Soviet rectal thermometer when she tried to put it in her mouth, and then the hospital staff were like, no, 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 and she couldn't understand, and the same thing. And she said at the time she was an adult.
They
still wanted to, in public, put that monster up her bum.
What was their fascination with keeping you guys in your pajamas?
It was rules, I guess. Soviet rules. I don't know, but my pajamas in that hospital and camp when I was put into hospital, where my pajamas were really not meant for, like, trotting around and having meals in, because my mom, I mean, they don't have them now, but my mom had packed. She knew it would be hot on the Black Sea, and our camp was on the Black Sea, and so it's semi-tropics there, and in the middle of the summer, and she knew it would be hot, so she sent me away this cute little pair of baby doll pajamas, which she thought were just darling, and it's, I was 11, and they were like a little short, frilly top, and then they had the bloomers, like a baby would wear over its diaper. And so it had these big baggy bloomers, and of course, and there was space in between, so you look like you're wearing something that a little baby would wear.
I had one of those.
Did you?
Yeah, my mother had made me wear those when I was a kid.
Yeah, why did they do that to us?
I don't know, but I'm having a very traumatizing flashback to
I know, and it's bizarre. And so, yeah, I had those, but I had to go out, and the whole hospital, even the kids were, like, so sick. They're sick enough to be in a hospital, and you had to go out and eat in a dining hall area, and you had to trot, and you had to go in your pajamas, and I had to wear my pajamas, and I don't know why, but the other kids, obviously, I mean, their parents probably, well, their parents were Soviet. I was the only, I other than a couple of other kids that were from other countries that were really sick, that were so sick that they weren't going out for meals, they all had, like, robes. I had my North Star running shoes on and my baby bottle pajamas and had to walk across this entire dining hall for my meals and eat in public in these awful baby things.
Oh. See, between that, the radiation, and your description of the bathrooms, I don't know what was worse. Although the bathroom sounded pretty bad. Was there, I mean, aside from the secret bathroom that you found?
Yeah, that was great.
That was...
we were so lucky we found that because the toilets were, I mean, at the camp, they didn't have doors on the toilet stalls at all. And they had a toilet bowl, but without a seat on it. And because the Soviet children were so, most of them had come from areas where they stood over a hole in the ground when they went to the bathroom. And so the Canadians, of course, we would sit on a bowl. But the first time I walked into this bathroom, and there were a pile of Soviet kids, and because they stood when they went going to the bathroom, they stood actually on the toilet bowls, and they were standing on the rim. And you'd walk in because there were no doors, and you'd see a lineup of girls standing on the toilet rim going to the bathroom there and standing facing you. And I was blown away. And it was just so incredibly, I don't know, it was so incredibly difficult for me to go to the bathroom that summer.
And no one prepared you for this at all?
No, but I don't think, I mean, so few people had actually been there, and none of the people who had sent me, other than the guy that ran the USSR Association, a lot of those people had never been there. So they were sending you somewhere that they didn't have a clue about. And, I mean, this was a place that, I mean, it wasn't like you went to camp and something went wrong and you could phone home. Mm. There was no phoning home from the USSR. I didn't, in fact, ever see, I didn't ever see, like, a payphone or something that you could use. I mean, to give you an example of what it was like there, the pop machines, you would line up for your pop, and everybody would be in line, and the pop would dispense into a glass that makes me think of like an old-fashioned shrimp cocktail glass. There's a little cup there, and the pop would dispense into it, and you'd drink at the pop machine, and then you'd put it back, and the next person would go, and so you'd have to stand there. So the entire country were sharing the same glasses at pop machines. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me I got sick.
Yeah, right. You got tonsillitis, which was treated with radiation.
And nobody phoned home because
there were no phones. But Adrian, through all this, is going around and saying to you, oh, no, this is a better way of doing it. Because with at home, when you get like a pop, there's so much litter and so much waste. Yes. But he's not. Was he really this blind? Like, he's like loving the tongue, like the raw tongue that you're served for lunch.
And, he ate and, all our food. our raw boiled tongue that had the taste buds still on it, and this was a big treat there, this thing, and we're looking at these, but and they had the taste buds. I mean, it was literally a cow's tongue, and it had all the taste buds on it, and you're looking at a tongue, and there's nothing done to this. It's not like sandwich meat tongue. It's got the taste. You have to cut through like the taste buds and whatever, but yeah, absolutely. He loved all of it. He was so in love with the USSR and the ideals, and so he was shocked that we wouldn't eat, and he'd come around after we had eaten, and he'd finish up all our food off the Canadian table.
But how could he have been so blind? I mean, he insisted that there was no crime in Russia, in the USSR.
A zealot, right? Yeah. It's somebody that's become so, I mean, it's not even indoctrination. It is in a way, but it's also, I mean, I know that he had reasons, and the Vietnam War was one of his reasons for becoming who he became. But he had his blinkers on just as much as anybody, you know, his blinkers were just the other blinker.
But if you went back now, do you think maybe not knowing what you know now, but if you went back as a slightly older kid, do you think you would have eaten the food?
No, none of them did. The 16-year-olds didn't. So we starved. The Canadians starved. We came home, and there was this lovely, plump farm boy from Saskatchewan who, I mean, he was just wonderful, Iggy. And he came, and he was just like a zest for life and a zest for food guy. And when he returned home, I mean, his belt was like, I mean, it had gone way past the holes, and they were doing them all the way around and cinching it tight. He was a skinny boy when he came home from the USSR. And I mean, and we all lost huge amounts of weight, and they were terrified about it. And I mean, in some ways, I know that that's part of being Canadian and being spoiled, because we have such great food in our country. Mm-hmm. And there were kids that came from the Middle East who did the opposite, and they would come, and they came to the camp, and they gorged on the food that we were spurning, and they thought it was so great. They were actually getting physically ill because they were eating so much meals that they ended up giving them 5 small meals a day and trying to, like, stop the intake of the food that we were spurning. We did have a right to spurn it in a way from what we had come from. It was shocking.
But didn't you get so hungry at one point that even the boiled fish with head and all looked appetizing? Or the runny kasha?
I don't think the scales on the potatoes or the whole thing. I don't think I ever found the I didn't like the food. And I'm a foodie. I love food. There was, you know, a couple of meals that I remember that I enjoyed. And one of them was on an airplane in the USSR. And that tells you how bad food is when the airplane meal that you got was the best meal you had in the entire country. And it came out of a paper bag. And it was just a little paper bag meal. And it was actually good.
Oh, right. Yeah, at the beginning, you got your paper bag meal, threw it out the window of your hotel, and found the window locked afterwards.
So, oh my gosh, that was so horrible that we did that. And I still think about what we did. Anytime I go up a high building and I'm looking about 22 stories down, I think about the fact that in the USSR, those windows just opened wide. They would never open here, right? There would be some sort of safety thing so you couldn't fall 22 stories. And there you could just open up the window in the hotel and look down, you know, however, you know, you'd look down, and it's really quite high. And I really realized how high it was again this summer when I was at the Hilton at Book Expo in Toronto, and I'm looking out of the window, and I'm looking down, like, 22 stories, and I thought, oh, my God, you dropped hard-boiled eggs out a window this high, and everybody's, like, so small down there. We could have killed someone, and I did. And that was me. I mean, my lunch was horrible. I had to hide the food. So I opened the window, what am I going to do with my lunch? And we would toss the food out the window, but we were caught pretty quick on that.
Yeah, they locked your window up.
Yeah, they did. Really, really, really fast. They did this, we were watched, and actually when I was talking to the translator who, she'd come from, the woman who did the translation that helped with the Russian in my book, she actually was on the trip with me, and she had gone, she lived in Halifax, and she ended up at 15 years old actually being accepted into Dalhousie University after pushing because she wanted to do Russian studies.
Oh, is that Mary?
So yeah, isn't that incredible that I talk to Mary now?
Yeah, I know, because you really hated her in the book. when you were 11.
and she's fabulous. She was actually at the book launch in Toronto. She showed up. She lives in Ottawa now because she does Russian translation, and she's an amazing woman. And I said, oh no, but I'm not really nice about you. And we were going through, you know, pictures and things like that. And she said, but Kirsten, she said, I'm beautiful now. And she is. She was from Halifax, and she was 15 years old when she went, and she came back, and Dalhousie University were like, no way you can come into, you haven't finished high school, you can't come into the university. And she actually proved how she spent the summer learning, like, it would have been great if I had done that, but she spent the summer and utilized it really well and learned how to speak Russian so incredibly well that the Russian studies program in Dalhousie let her in at 15 years of age. And then she went back, and she did another degree actually in the USSR, as did Alexei from British Columbia. He went back, and he went to the Moscow University as well. So there are a few kids that actually from it really, really grabbed this stuff. But I don't have no idea what I was talking.
Oh, you were talking about them following you and knowing what you guys are doing.
So she said absolutely. Absolutely, they did follow us, and she said because when she was back there, I mean, they did watch foreigners particularly well, and she said they did not want us to have huge contact with the other the Russian children. They did not want us, it had to be contact that was observed and monitored. They were so scared of Western contact. They were absolutely petrified, and so she said we were watched the whole time. And she said, it's no wonder they knew you were parachuting in seconds back at the main, you know, the main center at camp. It's no wonder that they knew, you know, all of the things that happened. She said they were watching us.
Do you know who was watching? I mean, was it the guy who was hitting on you in the track field?
She said we would have had people that actually, like, that's what they did for, they would watch us. They would, you know, we were being monitored at all times in some form. And so, I mean, I had no idea about that at the time, except, though, you did sort of wonder when so fast after a window could be sealed. It's like, or, you know, and the things that would happen, like, or how fast news could spread across the camp about the fact that you'd been parachuting, and it had been across the entire camp, and already it's known by the time, and you didn't even think they knew who you were. Okay. And there's 3,000 kids there. How did they know who you were?
Oh, wow. Your subtitle of the book is A Brat in the USSR. I had to say that you guys were a bit bratty. But do you actually look back and think, oh my God, I was such a brat?
Well, you know what? It was the managing editor of Turnstone Press that came up with the subtitle. Lost in Moscow is mine, and he came up with A Brat in the USSR. And I went, yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, for sure, Todd. That's great. And it, I liked it. And it is. I mean, it is. I mean, in some ways, I don't think that I was a bratty child, but I was naughty. I mean, I would land myself in circumstances, and I still do as an adult. I always plunk myself into something that I wish I hadn't plunked myself into. You know, I'm always in trouble. But that was a stroke of genius of Todd Besant at Turnstone Press.
Actually, you weren't the brattiest one.
No, I don't think so.
Dee Dee was definitely brattier than you. But then again, she also had all her luggage stolen.
Yeah. Well, you know, and we were talking with Dee Dee took me through all her, she had the slides of, she took about 800 photos that summer,
really?
And she came home with all her slides, and I went down to her place, and we went through the slideshow watching them all, and she still is, but she's still the same. If I'd walked past her on the street, I would have known her in a second, but she was so upset about, she said, you know, absolutely for certain, they took her luggage because her clothes stood out, because she had, you know, she had all the top designer names,
mm-hmm.
and she would have stood out. And she ended up, I mean, she got it back, but she spent the entire summer without her precious belongings, which is, for her, incredibly horrifying.
How did this affect you later, growing up, like in your teens? Like, did you think back at it and like go back to it whenever you were in a bad situation or served boiled fish? Or, I mean, aside from which time you're out looking out a window and thinking about how horrible it was that you threw hard boiled eggs, did it change you at all? Or
yeah, well, you know, I always wonder about, but I don't know what I'd be like if I hadn't been there. And so I know, like, in some, I know in ways, I'm sure there are ways that it has changed me. Like, I think that probably it has changed me in the sense of, you know, an independence at an early age, where you sort of have to really look after yourself and look out for yourself. Because as you know from reading it, I hid from some of the radiation treatment.
Yeah, and you ran away from
to me.
And you ran away from those guys in Red Square, the soldiers in Red Square.
Right, running and hiding.
Yeah.
Run, hide. I still do that. If ever I see, I run and hide even if I don't need to. It's incredible. Someone's at the door. Quick, run, hide. but
maybe it traumatized you.
I don't know. But yeah, you know, it's hard to say in some ways how it has changed you, because you don't know how you would have been.
Mm.
And yet at times I think there are probably things that, I mean, there are probably huge things that it has done to my life that that aren't even tangible to me. And I do think so. I mean, my zest for travel partly has come from that. And I love just going to some other country and just, you know, I mean, my second book, which I just finished, is also travel. It's about a number of the countries that I've been to and the strange circumstances. I always end up in strange circumstances, and I don't know why. But
because you're a fun person.
Because I'm running. I'm hiding. You didn't need to hide, honest. It has given me a zest for exploring, I think, is one of the things. I'm not sure that I would have been as big of an explorer as I am.
Have you been back to Moscow since?
No, you know what? I was going, I thought, like, last summer I ended up, I mountain biked across Transylvania, Romania, and I was actually, this is so weird, I Googled Easter Island, and Adventure Transylvania came up, and there's this guy, Horia, in Transylvania, Romania, he's a mountain biker who offers tours off-road through the mountains of Transylvania, Romania. And so
that's,
I typed
so cool.
Easter Island, I got Transylvania, Romania, and so I contacted him on the internet. He wanted you to wire money to his personal bank account.
Huh?
Not a company name or anything. Anyway, I did it with my sister-in-law from out west.
Oh my God, you're brave.
So we went. We just went, and and he was there at the airport. But I mean, but I do things that I think that most rational people would probably go, you know, it's probably not a good idea to just send a pile of euro to some guy's bank account in Transylvania. But so I think I think it's made me in some ways a big risk taker. And, you know, at the end of the day, I said, so if he's not there, he's not there. And so if he's not there, okay, so I've lost 700 euro or whatever. But it'll be a whole new adventure once I get there, you know.
And then you'll go to Moscow?
No, so, right, about Moscow. So at that, that was the other thing that I had been thinking about going to. Listen to how I babble. So that
no,
had been the
great.
Other thing I'd been thinking about going to. And I had gone online to the Lonely Planet's guide to Russia and Moscow. And it said in, like, one of the getting there and traveling there section, it had said that they are the most dangerous skies in the world to fly in.
Really?
That they're basically, it's almost like, they described it as like unmanned towers, and it's a free-for-all up there. And so I have the sneaking suspicions we're not probably hearing all the news about the little crashes that happen there. We only hear about the terrorist attack ones, maybe, or the possible suspicion ones. But they had said that, and that sort of deterred me a little. It's like, well, Orleonic, the camp I went to, is still there on the Black Sea. And I thought, wouldn't that be neat to go back? It's really cheap to go if people want to send their kids. It's really cheap. They include, like, the camp price and the flight from Moscow for, like, nothing. I mean, people could still get rid of their children if they want to.
Well, that's exciting. Aisha, what's your next book about?
It's Mountain Bike Adventures. It's called Fork Adventures in Mountain Biking Gluttony, and it's just going into editing. And I just finished it off this summer before I went to the Channel Islands. And it's about my mountain bike adventures around the world with my friends from across Canada that I hope are still friends.
You know, I have a friend who would love you. He's been on mountain bike adventures all over the world, including one to East Asia. I said it was East Asia.
Uh-huh.
And where he basically lost all his possessions but still managed to make it back. He was even on the news over there pleading for whomever it was to maybe not give back all the money, but at least the passport and his scrapbook.
Yay! Those are the most important things, I think. Yeah, my trip almost ended last summer, mountain biking. My trip almost ended because when I arrived at the airport and I had my mountain bike in a hard case, and because I've actually never done a supported trip in my life, and I thought, oh, it's supported, it's going to be so mamby-pamby. It was actually the hardest biking I've ever done in my life, but I had my bike, and I have this KHS. It's like $5,000 of it's all custom put together with the dual suspension. It's a beautiful bike. And so I had it in a hard case, and I had, you know, my little bit of luggage on top of that, and we're pushing in our trolleys in Bucharest at the airport, and we push out, and from behind, three gypsies were off and running with everything we had. They hit us from behind. They were off and running. Next second, they were in an elevator. And one of them had held the elevator, and they were in the elevator, and I'm standing there going, the trip's over. Trip's over.
Wow.
You're done. And then I jumped on board the elevator, which I think probably is one of the more stupid things I've ever done in my life.
You know, that actually, you know, if it weren't for you doing these things, it wouldn't be such great books.
Because I'm so stupid. I write good books.
I have to ask you, well, maybe adventuresome. Adventurous. Oh, that's what you're, not stupid, adventurous.
Stupid. It's really stupid.
What makes you want to
think? That's how you end up in an adventure. You do something stupid.
Why did you decide to write the book about the USSR, like, so many years later?
Oh, well, you know, that was an accident. This was an accident, an altogether accident that I wrote the book. I had been teaching university in England. I teach theater, and I was at East 15 Acting School, and I had directed a couple of shows for their third years and their postgraduates. And I went back home for, they have a month for their spring break. Their Easter break is a whole month long.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I know. They get four of those, and instead of having the big long summer holiday, they have the month long spread out throughout their year.
Nice.
And so I went back home for the month, and I had to get a new passport at the same time. And so I took my car in for an oil change on the way to go have my passport redone. So I had all my documents, all my papers in the glove box, took the car in for the oil change. It was stolen out of the service bay during
an oil change. Everything happens to you.
It was stolen. And I had all my papers. And I was born in England, and because my father's not my natural father, there was an adoption involved with that. And so there were all these things that would... It took me over a year to get my documents back, so I lost my job. I had nothing to do. I had lost my job, and I was like, well, what now? What are you going to do? And I don't know, I suddenly got the idea. I suddenly thought, you know, I had just written a play that had gone up in London, and it was, you know, it's really, I mean, I love theater, but then I realized that, you know, people can't, you like with a book, anyone can go out and just buy it. For someone to see your play, it has to be playing somewhere near you.
Right.
So,
yes, and you have to pay.
Right. A lot more.
Yeah,
people
and you can
go to see a play than buy a book.
And but the book you pay for it once and you can read it a billion times.
Yeah. And then some of my friends said, "I've lent it to 10 friends," and I'm like, "Okay, don't tell me that." Yeah, please stop lending it to friends. Buy it.
All right, I won't lend it to my friends then. I'll make them buy it.
I wondered if I still had my diary from the U.S., if my mom still had everything. And I actually called my mother up and, you know, I said, "Do you still have, you know, where, can you dig out the diary?" I knew she had it. "Can you dig out the diary and the scrapbook from my trip to the USSR?" And she said to me, she said, "Oh, I probably threw that out years ago." And I was like, "What?" I was like stunned, and I was just blown away, and that threw that all to whatever. But then my parents, they ended up moving to France, and in the process of mom sorting through all the garbage in the cupboards that you accumulated over years and years and years, she found my scrapbook and my diary, and she just one day delivered them to me, and I went, okay, well, I sat down and I opened up the diary, and then just from page one, I sat at the computer, and I mean, the book doesn't read like a diary. It reads as it happened to me, and I just relived each day.
That's really cool. All the stories about how you end up in place B from point A are really cool.
Thanks. I'd like to put that on the cover, actually. It was really cool. I'm going to tell Turnstone quick. I like that quote. CHRY said it's really cool.
It's really cool. Yeah, I'm sending them a copy of this, so you never know. All right, well, thanks a lot for talking to me today.
Oh, thanks, Sandra. It was great talking to you.
It was lots of fun, and the book is a lot of fun too, actually.
Thank
you. Although I was reading it in the commuter train.
Were you?
And I would read it, and I'd be snickering to myself, and I think people were starting to think I was insane.
Yeah, well, I was just a little girl just read it in Sick Kids, and I got a wonderful email about this little girl who's going, she's going through cancer, and it's not actually for kids. Actually, my book isn't really for kids, is it? Not at all.
I don't know. It could be good for kids.
It would depend on the parent.
It depends on the kid.
And the parent. I mean, there's people that burn Harry Potter, so it also depends.
Yeah, but it depends on the kid, because the kid can always sneak it around.
Yeah, and they do that. You know what's interesting? Because I have gone into a lot of schools to talk, because the book is based on a diary that I kept when I was 11. A lot of schools have had me in to talk to the kids about the fact that you could write something at age 11 that ends up becoming a book, or ends up being a journal, could be that relevant to you when you're older. Mm. And so I go into these schools, and I've actually had, oh no, I've and I bring the books back after, because I'll send like four copies out, that and they all now open to like chapters like all the kids in the USA are sex maniacs.
Oh, right.
All of them open. They've thumbed through to look for the bad words or the worst thing.
Well, that's what you do when you're a kid.
I know. So,
no one
else.
But how will you learn this otherwise?
A hidden kid book. But for, I think if you've lived through the 70s or grew up in the 70s or something, it'd probably have more meaning.
It kind of reminded me of otherwise known as Sheila the Great by Judy Blume, but like on acid or something. Like
Judy Blume had been on acid. Oh, that's even better, Sandra. There we go. I'm gonna email Todd when I get home. Judy Blume on acid. Wait till you read the next one.
Oh, I can't wait. I really can't wait to read the next one.
Thanks.
All right, I'll just finish this up. This one's never gonna end. So
okay.
Thanks for being here, and I look forward to your next book.
Thank you.
Kristin Koza's Lost in Moscow, A Brat in the USSR, is published by Turnstone Press.
Okay. Bye, Sandra.